Good day, Montreal. Well, we've gone through another great Canadian week of fatuous bureaucracy and paralytic social sickness. The week started well enough with the Prime Minister's call on the vote of Afghanistan, and of course 20 of the bravest Liberals who had launched the mission originally, including our former Prime Minister, didn't even bother show up to vote. And it was downhill from there, frankly. We've lived through a week where a young man named Chris Statham was stopped by Vermont cops because he had a little blunt of marijuana in his cigarette pack and told to write a mea culpa that the Montreal Gazette printed. It's one thing to have foreign law, but when foreign law uses our domestic press to enforce itself, there's something real wrong with this country. However, the week just got worse the following day when Quebec announced not only were they going to have inspectors to enforce this new anti-smoking laws, but they were going to have spies to report to the inspectors, to report to the bureaucrats of Quebec City, who were going to decide on whether or not there were going to be fines. And what made this all the worst was for 36 hours, you had all these talking heads around Montreal who were saying, well, that's okay. It's all right that there are spies because we have precedence for spies, since we had spies with the Office de la Langue Française. Well, by that brilliant reasoning, if precedent makes everything okay, why the hell are we reopening all kinds of wrongful conviction cases? Let's let Milgaard and Marshall and Morin and Truscott rot in prison. It was another just brilliant display of Canadian logic. Add to that, some bureaucrat from the Tobacco Policy Agency, there's now going to be an Agence de Politique de Tabac in Quebec, excuse me, said that they were going to denormalize behavior. Well, if they want to denormalize smoking, what's next? Denormalize eating? Denormalize skiing because it's too dangerous? We thought it couldn't get any worse. Well, it got worse. On Thursday, our brave Supreme Court of Cowards in Ottawa refused to review the banishment of Judge Andre Ruffo from the youth court bench. And as many of you know, we've had her on as a guest. She was dismissed from the bench by a judicial panel of Quebec Superior Court judges, not for malfeasance, not for any misfeasance, because she spoke out too much for some of the most vulnerable in our society. Gee, what a crime. She shamed ministers, she shamed the system, she shamed judges. And the Supreme Court refused to review. For my money, a court that's headed by a Chief Justice who claims that judicial activism is our tradition and we can change constitutional and charter wrongs and make them right and refuses to look at this glaring case of injustice isn't worth the bloody damn, and why don't they just rent out the Supreme Court building for condos? Well, internationally outdid even Canada, as we had this wonderful little man, the president of Iran, who finally got released out of parliament. Some new little hate laws demanding that Jews wear yellow-colored strips and Christians will wear red-colored strips and Zoroastrians blue-colored strips. But he sees nothing wrong with this because, of course, when a Muslim shakes hands with a non-Muslim, he becomes najis or unclean. So it's in that kind of a week, and we're going to examine Iran's hate laws. We're going to examine the Ruffo case. But there's an upside to this. You know, one of the nice things about doing this kind of a program is that you meet real people, and you meet people who, without money, without organizations, don't give a damn about statocratic bureaucrats, and they go out and do good. So we're also going to have with us Hal Newman, who's arguably one of Quebec's experts on emergency preparedness, on the urgent need for paramedics in Quebec, Quebec being the last jurisdiction in North America that doesn't have them. We're going to have Professor Stephen Getz and Merchants Association President Richard Tower Borelli discussing Walmart and the dangers to the inner city. And we're going to have special needs educator Pamela Ferez on the youth protection system. Oh, and by the way, for all you people out there who are maybe stuck in traffic right now because of demonstration by the bikers against this insanely huge increase in motorcycle fees that the Liberal government of Quebec has decided to do, we're very sorry you're stuck in traffic, but at least somebody's out there doing something. We'll be right back with you after this. Montreal, Canada, everybody listening on the World Wide Web, we're back. In studio with me is Rick McConomy. Throughout the show will be our good friend Hal Newman, president of Team EMS, and we'll be talking to him about the urgent need for paramedics. Remember, you can reach us by email at info@iapm.ca. The story of the week, the most revolting, pathetic display of a nation driven by a self-doubt, fueled by a jealousy of other self-belief, was Iran's possible and probable release of its newest hate law, which is the demand that Jews and Christians and Zoroastrians wear colored strips of cloth on their clothing. I want to read you this remarkable quote by the Minister of Islamic Orientation. His name is Mustafa Purhardanj. Our aim is to make sure that every Muslim, whether he or she happens to be on this earth, is a living and walking symbol of Islam. Now, if they're not on this earth, I don't know how they're going to be a walking symbol of Islam. But that quote comes from the story by the man who started the discussion on this in Canada, Amir Tahiri, and we welcome you from London. Thank you, Amir, for taking time out to chat with us on Sunday.
Thank you for having me.
Amir Tahiri has been on with us before. He's a world-renowned columnist, journalist, Iranian expert, Iranian dissident, if I may call you that. Amir, why is everybody so surprised by this law? This was from 2004. It's merely being released out of Parliament, or probably released out of Parliament. It's sort of like in the Canadian parallel would be the Senate has to ratify it. Why are all of a sudden people so surprised? When you wrote your op-ed in the National Post, it became front-page news when Chris Wadi reported on it. What's the surprise? What does the world think the Iranian this Iranian government is all about?
Well, first of all, a number of people inside in Iran are so shocked by this law, which has been stopped for the past 2 years. You know, they tried to railroad it through in 2004. They did not succeed. Now President Ahmadinejad, because he has a majority in the Islamic Majlis, Parliament, he managed to pass it. And, you know, they are appointing a committee to work out the details of its application. So those opposed to it in Tehran are trying to alert the international public opinion, the United Nations, the democratic countries, and so on, to prevent this law from coming into force, possibly at the end of this year.
What was the difference between the Supreme Guide? I think our listeners need to know that it is not the president of Iran in whom total executive power is vested. It's in the Supreme Council and in what they call the Supreme Guide, Ali Khamenei, right now. What moved Khamenei to indicate that this law would be released as opposed to his predecessor, Khatami, who was Ahmadinejad's predecessor, who held back on it? What's the mindset there?
The Supreme Guide is, in fact, fighting for his own life, because in November there will be elections for the Assembly of Experts, and this is a body that could remove the Supreme Guide from his position. Ahmadinejad and his group are trying to win control of that assembly and possibly threaten the position of the Supreme Guide. So what does the Supreme Guide do? He becomes even more extremist than Mr. Ahmadinejad's group. And we have seen it in a number of on a number of other issues, and this is one of them. The current Supreme Guide wants to say, I'm as Islamic as you, anybody could die, could be more Islamic than me, you die. And one of the moves he made was to give the green light for this obnoxious law to be passed by the Majlis.
So in other words, I think the lesson here is that when we hear extreme radical Islamists, when we hear the Wahhabis of Saudi Arabia, when we hear bin Laden talking about Islam, a return to Islamic hegemony of the 14th century, we need to remember that they're reverting back to their own history, because in the 14th and 13th and 12th centuries, Christians and Jews had a lower status, did they not, in legal lower status called dimitude. They were dimmies, and they had to wear badges that they were symbolizing pigs if they were Jews, and monkeys if they were Christians. They had to walk off the sidewalk if they saw a Muslim coming. They were taxed at the will. So this is really a reversion back to what they've been saying, a restoration of Middle Ages hegemony, is it not?
Yes, in fact, you know, it's not such a Middle Ages, because the statue of Zimmi for Christians and Jews and other religious minorities continued in the Ottoman Caliphate, in the Ottoman Empire, until the 1860s, and in Iran, which was the Qajar Empire at that time, until 1906. And these were supposed to be protected people in exchange for being allowed to practice their religion privately. They had to pay a special poll tax, and at the same time, there were some restrictions applied to them. For example, Jews and Christians could not build buildings or live in buildings that were higher than buildings built and lived in by Muslims.
What can a middle power like Canada, what should a middle power like Canada do in response to this as a first step? Recall ambassadors?
A middle power like Canada should be honest and truthful to its own values. If you believe in human rights, if you believe in equality of people's beliefs and freedom of conscience and so on, you cannot treat the present regime in Iran as an ordinary regime. You cannot conduct ordinary diplomatic relations with them. You cannot give it comfort and aid, as Canada unfortunately has been doing, you know, for many years. Perhaps, you know, Canadians want to demarcate themselves from the United States to say we are independent, etc. But, you know, your private quarrels or jealousies against the United States should not lead you into aiding and abetting a thoroughly obnoxious regime, which is oppressing the Iranian people, and now is really going beyond any red lines, because trying to create a so-called Islamic identity and marginalizing millions of Iranians because of their beliefs is really not on. We are in a different age.
Amir Tahiri, amen. Have a good afternoon, and I thank you for taking time out to join us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Amir. We'll be right back after this. Good, Montreal. We're starting to get some of you pissed off. There was just somebody who called in and said, I don't want to hear about any of this on the weekend. They haven't attacked us yet. Well, guess what, sleepyheads? Political Islam and this kind of neurotic, sclerotic, insane thinking is having an effect in the West. On Wednesday, a woman by the name of Ayan Hiris Ali, who's been a symbol in the fight against Islamist extremism, a woman who has sought asylum in the Netherlands from her native Somalia, a member of the Dutch Parliament, a woman who, when she arrived in Holland in 1992, said that she had lied on her application, was nonetheless elected, has been celebrated as a champion of free speech, excellent parliamentarian, and the minister of Dutch immigration, Rita Verdonk, who is running for the leadership of her party, laughingly, it's the Liberal Party in the Netherlands, decided to make an issue of it this week, and thankfully saw her political support plummet by 80%. And to discuss this and the Iranian decision and the issue of political Islam and how it affects us in the West, it's a remarkable woman named Homa Arjamand. Homa, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Homa's from Toronto, and she has been the leader in the international campaign against Sharia courts in Canada, fought that battle successfully in Ontario. And I just want to read you one short paragraph from an article she wrote this week called Political Islam Strikes Back, Dutch Revoked Citizenship of Ayan Hirsi Ali. And Homa, speaking in the name of organization, wrote, "We oppose the ambitions of political Islam and compliance of the Western governments towards it, and we denounce those governments like the Dutch and other Western governments that comply with the political agenda of Islamist regimes and Islamist movements. These regimes use their economic and diplomatic power under the guise of multiculturalism to advance their agenda and to silence free thought and expression." So, Homa, it's not just, as that other caller said, about what's happening in Iran. It's what's happening in our backyards, isn't it?
That's right. It's happening. It started a long time ago. In fact, we always emphasize that the Western governments are supporting political Islam. Otherwise, without their support, they wouldn't survive that long. So that's the reality. And in our idea, in my idea, I believe that this is to submit political Islam's demand to improve its relationship with Islamic regime and Islamist group. I strongly believe that this is an attack to a very well-known activist who stood up against political Islam to push her aside. So if we allow it to happen, it means that we did allow political Islam to win another step forward in the West.
Homa, you yourself are a refugee from Iran.
That's right.
Now, what is the Iranian mindset? That on the one side, they're going to enact laws that the majority of normal people in the world will find repulsive, and on the other side, they're trying to leverage that as what? As fear, as terror in the West against anti-Islamist politicians?
You know, and if humanity doesn't stand up against it, believe me, we would have a perfect Nazism in Iran. We would have another Hitler. So we have to stand up against it. We have to make our governments to back off and not to support political Islam in any way possible.
The people on the street in Iran, particularly in the urban centers, have traditionally been very, very modern, westward-looking. There was hope before the last election that, that the women and the students particularly could lead toward a more reformed government. Is there still any hope for that, or has everybody just gone underground and is fearful of the insanity of Ahmadinejad?
You know, I strongly believe that the society, the Iranian society, is a secular society. I strongly believe that the women's movement, the labor rights movement, and the students' uprising, it's there, active every single day, and we would not allow this happen.
Alma, please, I have to interrupt you. We've got to pay some bills and get some updates. Particularly, we've got a demonstration by bikers against the Liberal government. Go, bikers! We'll be back with Homa Arjaman right after this. Call Beryl, email Beryl, info@iapm.ca. Back with you, Rick McConomy in studio with us. Homa Arjaman, head of the International Campaign Against Sharia Courts in Canada, is on the line with us from Toronto.
Rick McConomy in Montreal, Homa.
Yes.
I want to ask you, on a day-to-day basis, a person who is wearing a flag or a piece of cloth that identifies them as being outside of the acceptable population, how does that impact on their employment, their education, their ability to get social services? How does that impact on their life?
I don't want to go that far. I think we should not allow it anyway, period. It would affect them. It would put them for a debt. It just put them vulnerable for any kind of attack from Islamists. It's worse than the Hitler time. If you allow a person be identified in a country where the extremists walk around freely, they can do anything freely, they can attack anyone freely, so how do you expect them to survive even one day?
And the government passes legislation to identify the people that are not acceptable, the people you're going to discriminate against and pick on, even on the street, walking up and down.
You know, right now it's just talking about it has been proposed to the government, but I think humanity has to stand up and go against it harshly. We should not allow it.
Homa, on that point, you're a pretty savvy political operator. You won this campaign against Sharia courts in Ontario and when everybody was trying to be politically correct. To Prime Minister Harper's credit, he came out immediately and called this Nazi-like. But what should Canada do and what should we tell our public officials to do?
No political relationship. Canada should not have any kind of political relationship with Iranian government, with Iranian regime.
And what do you tell? And what do you tell those people who say, "Well, you know, he doesn't really mean it. He's just trying to get back at America. We have to be understanding of the different cultures."
You know what? I think they're not opening their eyes wisely. The fact that
are they worse than that?
Yes.
Are they fifth columnists?
I think so. There are 3 million refugees across the world.
From Iran?
Yes. Can't they
3 million.
And look what Islamist terrorists is doing outside of their own region as well.
SAVAK, look, which was the secret political police, did a good job.
That's right. And look at what Hamas is doing. And you know, recently, just to let you know, the scientific council... and the Scientific Council for the Government in Dutch, they have passed and they have promoted this action that the Dutch government should go outside and meet with the leaders of Hamas.
So we have to show our strength and we have to stop backing and supporting these kinds of regimes.
You know what? I think we have to push pressure on our governments here in Canada, in Western countries, to stop the political relationship with Islamist regime. Totally.
And Homa, you know what? It may not be a bad idea for Canada to offer land and immigrant status to Ayaan Hirsi Ali. I know she's trying to get it in the States. Why don't we give it to her?
Well, you know what?
That'll be a signal to the world.
All activists, they have to push pressure on their government to propose this to Ayaan Hirsi Ali so she would know she's wanted. She is wanted. If one country is rejecting her, there are other countries that are willing to accept her.
And for our listeners, just to remind our listeners that it was in the Netherlands, it was in Amsterdam, it was in broad daylight that Theo van Gogh, the grandson of the painter, was killed by an Islamist jihadist. And as he was being killed and as his throat was being slashed and gutted, he said to the attacker, "Let's talk, we can reason." And they killed him anyway. In the middle of the day,
we have to stop tolerating intolerance. That's what we have to do.
Defending Ayaan Hirsi Ali means opposing political Islam, means opposing Islamist terrorism.
Homa Arjomand, if we have more citizens like you, maybe Canada will get the maturity it needs. We thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Montreal, we'll be back right after this. Andy, you're not happy with something.
No, I'm not.
What aren't you happy with?
Well, I'm not happy with the whole idea, the uproar that people are creating with what the Iranian parliament is doing.
Why? You like what the Iranian parliament is doing?
No, but there's one thing. At least they show their true face, while most of the other governments...
Are you out of your mind, Andy? Their true faith? This is the same faith that Hitler showed when he passed the badge law, which also passed the Nuremberg laws, that said that it was a criminal offense for a Jew to hold hands with a non-Jew. You like that true faith? It's the problem with people like you who think that faith is somehow should be raised to a secular right that is ruining Western liberal civilization. We didn't die for that, and the Holocaust, if it's to have any possibility of living witness and living memory and living meaning, has to wipe out the kind of crazy mindset that you're showing. You're gone.
Goodbye, Andy.
Beryl, tell us how you really feel.
God! I mean, what is the point? Canada, Montreal, the world, if you've learned nothing, if you can even have thoughts like that, religious sacrament is not the same level as secular right. We're supposed to celebrate our common universalities, not our bloody parochial particularities.
We start with laws.
My God,
that
they showed their true religious colors.
Show me
God
who the enemy is. Make him wear a special badge. Show me who the enemy is.
8 months ago, Muqtada al-Sadr, who was fighting the Americans, who was killing civilians, his own people in Iraq, a cleric, said that the Americans think that they're giving us liberty from our religious restrictions while we find liberty in our religious restrictions. Well, that kind of crazy talk has been reflected in every religion possible. You've even had rabbis who said that 1.2 million children died in the Holocaust because somehow they weren't following God's law. What kind of insanity is rampant out there? To continue with some more insanity right here at home, not on the same level,
I'll give you some insanity. Last week we talked about confidentiality and adoptions. Buried inside of the La Presse is an article saying they've created a committee to look at it. They created a committee because a committee in 1999 said lift the confidentiality. So now in 2006, they're creating a committee
to
decide.
The first committee.
Absolutely,
perfect.
Because they couldn't follow the first committee.
So this is a great legal system at work.
It's wonderful. And they're going to report in November. Any committee that is going to report already has the report written. Ladies and gentlemen, somebody for you to write to, talk to, get a hold of. Maître Carmen Lavallée of the University of Sherbrooke. Maître Lavallée is an expert in adoption. I don't know whether Maître Lavallée loves
her, is she?
Aha, what can I tell you?
St. Luke chapter 14, verse 1. Woe unto ye lawyers, for ye did graves for your fathers before they are yet dead.
And in this life we live, without the lawyers, you wouldn't get anywhere. So don't start with me again.
Please.
Okay?
It's a bum profession.
CIMARD report, 1999, lift confidentiality. Now we have to have a new report to tell us the same thing. We got plays at Centaur Theater telling it's ridiculous.
Well,
on with it.
As far as I'm concerned, the one thing that may be worse than the lawyers is the judges. And joining us now is Andre Ruffo, and I'm still going to call you Judge Andre Ruffo, Andre. What a bloody profession. What a pack of wolves you got. Your confrères and consoeurs are. I just want to bring to the attention of our listeners before we get to your particular case. This is the same Supreme Court that refused your review that decided in that decision called Tessling that it was okay for cops to fly over your house with ultra-red sensors to see if you have heat emanating from your house, because this Mr. Tesling had been growing marijuana plants in his house. Now, obviously, if you're growing in your house, you're not exactly Lucky Luciano and distributing liquor through everywhere. And so that kind of invasion of privacy is okay. That the Supreme Court will rule yes on. But to review the case of arguably the most important activist judge Quebec has produced in a generation, that they wouldn't do. How do you feel about your confrères and consoeurs, cher André?
Well, I think that, you know, rethinking institutions that are no longer serving the purpose that they should have served, I think that is maybe demanding or asking a little too much. There's a huge crisis about justice and about the belief that we can have access to justice now in Canada. But that's not what I'm going to speak. I'm going to speak about youth court judges who are no longer judges. They are people who are just serving the DYP. 98 to 99% of the recommendations of the DYP are followed. Most of those judges, almost 85 to 90%, come from being civil servants. They are afraid to speak, afraid to stand. Of course, the message is very clear.
And the DYP bureaucrats are some of the youngest and most ill-trained in the whole Quebec bureaucracy.
Yes. And I think that whatever I've been saying for 20 years is the truth. The region
we've known
where
that.
I was, everybody knows that. The
As Rick just said, we know that. We've known that.
We've known that.
And
forever.
So do the judges. André, stay with us. He's got to pay a bill. We'll be right back with you.
Get out there and protest.
Before we get back to Judge Rufo, we feel bad for all you motorists stuck in traffic, but my God, at least somebody's protesting some inane law. And, you know, when you talk to people like Homa Arjemand and André Rufo, you get a little bit of hope left that there are some people of conscience out there that are willing to put themselves on the line. André Rufo.
André, yes. I interviewed a young lawyer this week at the office. She came in and she said, I can't go on working at the youth court. I am the lawyer for a social worker. I'm not the lawyer for a child, and I'm not the lawyer for a proper solution.
That's one of the biggest problems that you're telling us now. It's the conflict of interest. The lawyers of the Youth Protection Director are representing the Youth Protection Director, but they allow themselves to say that they represent children's interests. Well, children do have lawyers, and a lot of time they're in opposition. So, and they don't seem to be shy, and they don't seem to care about that conflict of interest that goes on and on and on forever. They choose the psychologist. They pay the psychologist who will evaluate the situation of children. They don't seem to have a problem with that. So whatever they do, it's a monopole. It's an institution
right.
That is so, so rich and so strong that there's no place for justice and there's no place for children's rights and there are no places for children's lawyers and a judge who would want to be independent. So that is quite clear.
André, what are you going to do now? I know you're not going to stay silent.
No,
Supreme Court or
not.
No Supreme Court.
No, of course. I feel free. I feel good. And what I'll do, I'll take a little moment to rest and to see what's going on. And I'll continue with a lot more determination, energy, and freedom. The night that it was announced that I was resigning, I had people phoning me to ask me to represent them.
There's an office in my office.
I've already got a letter, actually, from a fellow in Ottawa who's got a situation here in Quebec.
I know, but I will not go back to the bar. For sure, I'm not going to go in politics. But I will be so loud, and I will be demanding so much resources and so much justice for children that I think they will regret the decision to make me silent.
It takes that huge energy that you've got, and you're just going to stick it to them, and I hope we're all there to help you.
Thank you very much. You're very kind. Thank you.
Bye-bye. I want to remind our listeners that Edward Gibbon once wrote that a civilization begins to decay when its governors are occupied only with vices and voices they seek to demonize. And what the Supreme Court failed horribly to this country in reviewing the Rufo case is only another example of Canada rotting away. André Rufo, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for asking me. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Not everybody is just sitting back and taking it. Not André Rufo, not Homa Arjemand, and not our next guest, a remarkable woman named Pamela Perez. Last week we did a story, as you may recall, on a couple in Verdun who lost their children because a youth protection worker decided that they needed to be taken away because they were being homeschooled because the school board couldn't protect one of the sons, couldn't guarantee the safety of one of the sons with type 1 diabetes.
The second social worker, the other social worker said the opposite.
That's correct. And they changed social workers at the request of the school board, not, who said
you
it was the request
it.
Of the parents.
Shopping.
The parents didn't know anything about it.
Shopping, shopping.
Pamela Perez is a special needs educator, master's in that field, ran perhaps the premier school with 160 kids with special needs on the West Island. She got fed up with this bureaucracy and just went up north, adopted four children with special needs, and is taking care of her. And right after this break, we're going to talk to her about what it takes and how our system fails challenged children. We'll be right back with you after this. Pamela Perez, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Beryl.
Good afternoon, Pamela.
Hi.
You have a big fan, by the way, in studio, Hal Newman. You may not have met him, but he lives very close to where your school was.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he was a neighbor for some time.
Sorry, we have a technical glitch. His mic's not on.
Actually, Pamela, you might remember me. I used to run Côte Saint-Luc EMS. We came up to give you a CPR.
That's right. Hi, Hal.
Hey, how are you? And I'm sorry that you're gone. I couldn't believe they relocated your school into the middle of an industrial park, and then they ran you out of town on a rail.
Yeah. Well, nobody really ran me out of town.
Pamela Perez out of town.
It more had to do with God and saying, look, you need some peace, and you need to look at things differently. So I'm very happy that I moved.
Pamela, you heard part of our show last week about these poor parents in Verdun that lost their kids. You are taking care of four special needs youngsters that you've adopted. They range in age from 8 months to 16 years, I believe?
That's right. That's right.
Why does the system fail? Why do we have a system without any compassionate authority where you have this, and I'm sure it's not a singular case. I mean, here's a couple who were going along just fine under the guidance of Margaret Mitchell from the school board. They had a social worker they were working with for 2.5 years. All of a sudden, Mitchell leaves. Somebody decides to give a Francophone social worker to an Anglophone couple, and all hell breaks loose. How does it break down like that?
Well, actually, it makes no sense, but I think the realization that we need to create a vision for everybody to learn what excellence is. I think that that's something that's key. I think that it's really important that people are able to see what is excellent. What is someone doing that's really good? And we need to promote that a lot more, totally, in the social service system, in the sector of education, all the different sectors that, unfortunately, are the sectors that are failing the most. I mean,
Pamela, aren't we creating a system now where we make exceptions? I mean, individual people in leadership positions make exceptions. When they go, the exception doesn't stay. It's not something that's in the system. It's not fairness in the system. It's the idea that the system's wrong, so if I pull people out enough, I don't have to change the system.
Well, I think that the system will change if we look at what the vision is. What is excellence? What is good? What is a good social worker? If we promote our leaders more, if we learn who our leaders are.
Right.
If you had to put a percentage on it, what percentage of kids in trouble, in trauma, emotionally, physically challenged, are really protected by our systems, educational and social?
Well, I think that they are protected somewhat. I think that.
So you're not even ready to go to 1%.
I think that they're protected somewhat, but I think that if we really want change to happen, we have to look at the whole system and see what we can do to make changes, to make improvements so people can be more accountable, people can understand what excellence means.
So we're talking about reversing. I mean, we're talking here about getting rid of the confidentiality on adoptions. That's a total reversal. Do we have to take that damn system and reverse it completely?
Well, I know for me, I love the fact that I was able to stay open with one of the families that I adopted from. And I think that that's a wonderful thing. And I think that it's most people look at it, oh, my gosh. But I think we need to think out of the box more. And I think that in this the social system and education system, we're not allowed to think out of the box if we're part of the system.
Pamela, hold that thought. We just got to pay a bill because they're going to shoot me along with everybody else who's in line to shoot me. We'll be back right after this. We've been talking the last half hour about the statocratic control in our society. We've become a society of abolition, not a society of solution. We've become a society first to abolish, last to discuss. We don't provide solutions. We just provide inspectors and bureaucrats, not to progress anything, but just to hold back everything and to extend the reach of government. And on the line with us still is Pamela Ferez on How the System Fails Challenge Kids. Pamela, I think they would like to hear your story, your personal story right now. We know you ran the premier school for challenged kids, 160 kids. You couldn't take the bureaucracy after 12 years. Your own board tried to take the school out from under you. What's your story now?
Well,
very dramatic.
When I was young, I basically was told that I wouldn't be able to make it out of high school because I didn't have the intelligence. Some labeled me slow learner. Some labeled me, I guess, even intellectually handicapped. But I always had a drive, and I knew that there was a mission for me in life, and that was to work with children and to help people learn to value and realize everybody has incredible potential. So I went on, and I ended up getting a master's degree in special education and graduating with honors. I also won very, very many incredible awards, one of them being Canada's Top 40 Under 40, which meets yearly to discuss also solutions and to help each other carry on and do what we need to do to help Canada.
And now you're living north.
And now
north of Montreal.
That's right. Now I live up in heaven. I basically believe that I died and went to heaven because God believed that I did so many great things, and he said, it's time for you now. And so I moved up, and I back on a beautiful river, and I front on the mountains, and I swim all summer long with the four wonderful kids, true angels. I have a 16-year-old who has autism, Down syndrome, and microcephaly. I have a 10-year-old who had a cleft lip and palate that was repaired. I have a third child who has a chondroplasia, which is a form of dwarfism. She also has spina bifida and dysphasia. And my latest one, I got when he was a month old, and he's now 8 months old, and he has Down syndrome. So basically, I have four little angels that we all live together, and we go for beautiful walks in the forest, and we do a lot of wonderful things up here in Morin Heights.
And you're doing this on your own? No programs, no bureaucrats, no statocrats?
I'm doing it on my own.
You're homeschooling challenge kids?
I'm not homeschooling, and they are going to school. They are
the regular schools?
They're going to the regular school system, yes, they are. But I also know the system well, and I know what monies come in, what money goes out, and because I dealt in that area for so long, I can also help fight the fight to get them exactly what's needed based on what I know that is out there.
You mentioned earlier keeping contact with the birth parents.
Yes, yes. My third child, who's 5 years old, I keep in contact. As a matter of fact, they're here today with me. And basically, they're babysitting the kids while I'm on the phone. And they basically come up, and we do things together. For instance, Shanice's birthday or different activities we do together. And I think that it's something's really important. As she grows older, she understands that she has two moms and she has a dad. And it's just, to me, it's an extension of the family. And they've helped me in very, very difficult times when I've needed babysitters because I've had to run off to the hospital with one of them. So they've become very special and dear to my life.
So now you're with extended family and making this whole thing work.
That's right. Extended family. My parents also have learned a lot about differently abled and realized how wonderful my kids are. I mean, they're literal angels. Anybody could come and babysit and basically thinks these children are just absolutely wonders.
There was a child psychiatrist actually in Paris called Françoise Dalto, Dr. Françoise Dalto. She came here about 10 years ago. She talked about the open family and the family that there's birth parents, there's nurturing parents, there's caring parents, there's people that have different roles to do with children.
Absolutely.
And basically, it's a big open field of positivism, and I think this is what we're talking about. We're talking about being positive. We're talking about stopping defending and making things illegal and making things wrong and chasing after people.
And, Rick, there's another part of Pamela's story that's very important to make our listeners understand. She's not an organization. She's not loaded with money. She's not independently wealthy. She doesn't have a bureaucracy behind her. And she's just a single individual who decided to make a corner of her world better. And that's what everybody can do.
Arthur Ashe once was asked about community work, and he said it's real simple. You start where you are, you use what you got, and you do what you can. And
yeah,
it's a very simple
much, yeah.
trio.
Yeah, no, and that's I feel very strongly about that. And I also try to empower the people around me to see the strength in all my children, to see their gifts and their actual wonderment in each and every child that I have in this home. They have so much to offer our world. And if we work together and if we work to see their strengths and their abilities, anything is possible.
Pamela Ferez, congratulations on the work you're doing. Anything you need, you just call us at the Institute. And
thank
it's been a pleasure
you.
Having you here.
Pamela,
thank you very much. I really
Pamela, we
it.
Love you. You're out there doing it for all of us.
Thank you very much, everyone. It's really, really nice. I'm very grateful to have come back and had time to speak with you guys. I've been away a long time, but it's really refreshing. Thank you very much, everyone.
Keep in touch.
Pamela,
okay.
Take care. Montreal will be back after this. Homa Arjamand, Andre Ruffo, Pamela Ferez, citizens making a difference. Without the bureaucrats, without the statocrats, without the abolition of anything, just the promotion of things that are positive. Unfortunately, in Quebec today, all we hear about are things that are illegal, things we can't do. And the core issues, the core political and distributive and service issues the government provide goes unprovided for. I want to read something to you all, and I want you to listen carefully. I was there when Mrs. Rosenberg died. She was everybody's grandmother. She called 911 after enduring crushing chest pains all night. She said she didn't want to wake anyone up. It's been more than 6 years since Mrs. Rosenberg died. I wrote about her death in the newspaper. I read about her passing on the radio. I shared her death with thousands of people across this land. Wherever I talked and or taught, I told folks about Mrs. Rosenberg and how she died, gasping for breath on the floor of her living room within view of the dozens of photos of her children and grandchildren. She died because I refused to break the law. I probably could have saved her. I could have inserted an endotracheal tube into her airway. I could have established an intravenous line in her arm. I could have administered drugs to combat the deadly arrhythmia in her heartbeat. I don't know for sure that Mrs. Rosenberg would have made it home again. All I know is I didn't do anything more than the law allows. She died. 6 years have passed, and Mrs. Rosenberg is still dead. The man who wrote those words is with us today, Hal Newman. And Hal isn't just a friend and an advisor to the Institute, but a man who's been involved in emergency preparedness, medical first responder units, one of the perfectors of the Kotzenluk EMS system. He's president of Team EMS, which is a leader in this field. And he's here today to tell us and to talk to us and to explain to us why Quebec is the only jurisdiction in North America without a paramedic system and what we need to do. Hal, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks, Beryl. Thanks, Rick. Actually, we're the only jurisdiction in the G8 that doesn't have
in
advanced
the
care paramedics.
Well, the G7, we don't know about Russia. But at least the G7.
Russia has advanced care paramedics.
Really?
Yes.
Amazing.
Absolutely. But we practice resurrection care here for a secular state. It's
explain,
rather interesting.
Explain what that means to the audience.
That's when someone's near death. The concept is that we pull them in from one foot in death's door. We high-five each other. And we move on. Unfortunately, the we would be the ER docs. That isn't out on the street. The paradigm for ambulance service here is that if you survive the accident or the reason you called 911,
the incident,
and you make it to the ER, well, that's miraculous, and maybe a good doctor will save your life. The ambulance ride is simply a ride.
What's Quebec's reason?
Don't know what the reason is. It's incredible, though. It's been the fight's been ongoing for 30 years now.
So we have money for tons of inspectors. Tens of thousands of inspectors, new rules, but we don't have the money to create, not even to create, just to expand and make illegal an existing paramedic structure.
Beryl, you know Marcel Boucher. He used to be the director.
Yes, I was going to bring that up.
Okay,
yes.
Marcel Boucher, Dr. Marcel Boucher, used to be the director of professional services at Agence Santé. He created the first advanced care paramedic pilot training program. He ran 18 paramedics through the Agence Santé program. It was recognized, certified right across Canada. And so how did we react in Quebec? Well, our government investigated him, pulled the Spanish Inquisition.
I hope it wasn't an investigation like Rick's talking about. It took 11 months.
It was an incredibly long investigation, and then they ran him out.
Because he wanted to save lives.
Right. He wanted to save lives.
Not just push paper.
Right. So he has 18 paramedics, street ready, but they still can't operate on their own. They're still being babysit by doctors.
Amazing. Montreal, we want to hear from you if you've ever had such a circumstance happen in your family. And we'll be back with you after these commercials and the news. Welcome back, Montreal. We're talking today with people who make a difference. And by the way, to those stuck in traffic because of the bikers, we sympathize with you. We're glad to hear from you. But, you know, people get angry and they get into the streets. And when you're going from $200 to $1,500 for nothing, for a government that dares not care, that runs between the raindrops, that can't tell right from wrong, you get out in the streets, and a little anarchy will do everybody some good.
So you're a target.
So sweet the sound of 1,000 Harleys.
Let's hear it. All right, go Harley. Let's get serious. Guys, relax.
Up.
In studios, Rick McConaughey and our special guest, Hal Newman of Team EMS. And Hal's telling us the screwed-up system in Quebec that is the only jurisdiction in the G8, including Russia, that doesn't allow paramedics. And we read you his very moving piece before. Hal, in your background, can you think of a case that stands out that would have benefited from paramedics that was just glaring?
You know what's incredible is the night Renny Levesque passed away. Renny Levesque, the ambulance left from, he had a heart attack, and the ambulance left from NDG to Nuns Island, and won't even discuss the response time. But on that ambulance was an advanced care paramedic who will go unnamed. Had he been allowed, he might have been able to resuscitate Renny Levesque.
And when he arrived, Levesque was still breathing?
I don't know. I don't know the circumstances. However, the response time from NDG would have been about 20 minutes out.
Right.
And so I remember that night, a group of us, we were gathered. So
instead of a boulevard named Renny Levesque, we may have still had Renny Levesque the man.
Right. And I remember that night. I remember the night at the Montreal General standing with a group of paramedics saying, wow, you think maybe they'll finally recognize paramedics? You know, Renny Levesque. Just killed Renny Levesque with our ambulance system.
Hal, we've got Jason who wants to have a word. Jason, welcome.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
I'm a reporter with the Suburban. I got a chance to actually follow around one of these paramedics, one of these advanced care paramedics, one of the last ones trained in.
You're the guy who wrote the story. Paramedic push loses ally.
That's it. And the week after we had a photo essay following around this guy, Michael Harding, who was one of the last ones trained at Dawson before they abolished the program to train paramedics. And he's been telling me that he's been walking, he's been a part of this fight since that time, basically, I guess.
Now we got two knowledgeable people. Hal, Jason, you're from the press. Hal, you're from inside the system. Can anybody in the government give any kind of reasonable excuse for why we don't recognize paramedics? They're already trained, it seems.
There's no political will to have advanced care paramedics. We want to have a system of universal mediocrity, sticky side down, Band-Aid pushing ambulance techs. That's what the government wants.
Jason,
what's your
that?
Experience?
That's bullshit. Jason, what do you think?
Well, it's actually, as slow as it's moving, actually, it seems like there's actually some movement. It seems like a political will is actually changing a little bit in Quebec from what I've...
Well, why didn't it change 10 years ago when most jurisdictions had them?
Well, Quebec is a distinct society, actually. It was actually
Bullshit. Tell us what's happening. What's happening new?
Yeah, Jason, tell me, where's the progress? Because I'll tell you, the other day, one of my neighbors went down. They called 911. Never mind first response. We live in Pointe Claire. There was no fire department first response. I don't know where the ambulance came from. There were no advanced care paramedics on it. So where's the change? Show me the change. I'd love to see the change.
According to what I've been told, there's a work group that's been put together with paramedics, with representatives from...
A work group? This would be about the 10th committee in 10 years. A work group? Do we need another work group to tell us that we need advanced care paramedics? You've got to be kidding me.
But they've actually said that they've mandated them to find a way to get these guys legalized.
Jason, even you're laughing as you say that. Is this a problem with the College of Physicians and Surgeons in Quebec?
They have a lot of power. Obviously, the College of Physicians
and the College of Physicians and Surgeons are the ones that are stopping foreign doctors and nurses that we need so badly from having their credentials recognized, including a group of 30 medical students from Dublin. Isn't that where the problem lies? Isn't the political will that the government will not take on the doctors?
But interestingly enough, it's a paramedic who was telling me that he's actually feeling confident about it. Stefan Scalabrini, who's the union rep for RETAC, he was telling me, well, within a year, we think that it's going to actually...
Within a year, that's wonderful. You know that...
It's the College of Physicians that actually has come
Jason,
around.
Jason, my paramedic instructor was the late...
Hal, Jace, we're going to continue this in 2 seconds because they're going to start shooting at us. They want to pay some bills over there.
That's worse bullshit than the bullshit we're going through. These commercials. Give me a break.
Stay with us, Jace. We'll be right back. And we're back, and we're talking with people who make a difference. We were just in the middle of a discussion between Jason and Hal Newman on the paramedic situation.
Actually, Jason, sorry, I didn't mean to sound like I was attacking you because I know you covered the story and you were one of the few reporters who covers the story. What's your take on the fire department first response program, which seems to me dead in the water, circling the drain, won't last till Christmas, a whole bunch of different acronyms?
Well, that's very curious because there was an agreement that was put in place, I guess it's almost 2 years ago, almost 2 years ago, between Montreal and its union to put this service together. And it's now up to Quebec to provide the funding, and it's been delay after delay. And the last delay I've heard is in June they're going to have an announcement. They want to announce it by the end of June, but obviously don't hold your breath for that one either.
Amazing. They're so quick to put in inspectors about smokers and abolish everything else and restrict everything, but simply to say that we need to save lives, that takes years and committees. Jason,
I did a story. Sorry, Beryl. Am I still here? Yeah,
you did a story in April.
Yeah, I did a story quite a while ago, that someone who potentially had a spinal injury in St. Anne de Bellevue had to wait on his back for 23 minutes for an ambulance to arrive.
Unbelievable.
And if there were first responders, they would have been there within two. And we've been waiting for this for 5 years. It was Gerald Tremblay is one of his original election.
Exactly.
Matches,
big promise.
Still nothing there.
Listen, Jason, stay on top of this. It's a big piece of business for us. We'll
hey, thanks, Jason.
Jason, thanks a lot for calling.
Take care.
Take care, man. Richard Tarabarelli is president of the Masson Street Merchant Association. Little guy. Well-known businessman in the small business community in Masson Street. He doesn't want to be eaten up by a giant. That giant is named Walmart. Stephen Getz is a professor at Penn State who's written an extraordinary study that's published in the latest issue of Social Science Quarterly that shows that where Walmart stores exist, 15.3% of the people need food stamps in the United States. The reason that Walmart can be a danger is not only that they push out through real estate grabs small and family businesses, but they force suppliers of their products, if they want to sell to Walmart, to push their prices down. So those companies, the suppliers, are forced to cut jobs, send them overseas into cheap slave markets. And this has been done in the Carolina Mills in South Carolina, the Master Lock Company of Milwaukee, Nabisco. On and on and on. We're pleased to have Professor Stephen Getz from Penn State and Richard Tarabarelli from the Masson Street Merchant Association. Richard, let me pose the first question to you.
Yes.
What started this latest discussion about Walmart coming into the inner city, into the inner core of Montreal? We know we have it in the suburbs, and we've got it in the periphery core. Where's the indication they're going to be coming into the inner core?
What we're afraid of, lately we heard that Walmart was saying that they want to open a few more stores in Montreal, like four or five, I think. They want to bring up to 15. And we know that Mr. Tremblay was dealing with them for the Carrière Miron, the old Carrière Miron, that it's near Fleury Street. And we have some few space that we heard that maybe they're going to move the bus garage on Mont-Royal and place like that. And we're afraid that Montreal are going to give them the right to build a Walmart. Walmart's supposed
so
to...
So they've gone location shopping.
Yeah, that's it. And we're afraid that it's all small street in the community.
Let me just explain this to Professor Goetz. Stephen Goetz, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, my pleasure.
The area that Richard is talking about is very, very densely populated, one of the most densely populated in Montreal, and borders on one of the poorest areas. Now, with that kind of a profile, what does that say in relation to the work you've done on Walmart?
Well, it's interesting. I mean,
and the higher poverty rates it can cause.
Well, it's interesting that they're expanding into urban areas, first of all, which they haven't been doing before. Based on our results, what that would suggest is that overall, at the community-wide, the poverty rate may well go up, depending on what's happening.
And why does that happen, from your perspective?
Well, we think a number of things take place. One of the important ones that we're also finding in subsequent research is that the social capital of the civic capacity that exists in communities is basically destroyed. And my experience is more in rural areas, but I imagine that it would be similar in urban areas, where you have the community leaders who are often the small business owners and the bankers and the lawyers and so forth, who are driven out basically because their livelihoods are wiped out. And as a result, you lose what we call the civic capacity or social capital in communities that can help communities deal with problems that are of a public nature as opposed to private. So we think that goes a long way in explaining what we're observing.
Stephen, Richard, stay with us. We're just going to pay some bills, and we'll come back and talk about Walmart's race to the bottom.
Bills.
Be right back. Hi, we're back, and we're talking to Professor Stephen Goetz of Penn State University, who's done a study that shows that Walmart equals higher poverty rates. Richard Tarabarelli, the president of the Massillon Street Merchants Association. Richard, you heard Professor Goetz talk about the fact that Walmart cuts social interaction and social activity in the community. Can you see that happening up on Massillon Street in the surrounding area?
We've not been touched by that so far because they're quite far away from us in the distance. But we know that we're very close to our community and neighbors, and we know that the Massillon Street, like any other street, are the heart of the district. It's normal. And neither one can live with the other, without the other.
Right. Professor Goetz, just a question back to Professor Goetz. This isn't the first time we've seen this either in the United States or in North America. In the 30s, the Great Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company, the remnant of which is A&P Stores, was five times the size of Walmart, did the same kind of almost criminal tactics against its suppliers, the pressure to bring prices down, and the Roosevelt administration broke it up. Is there any discussion about the United States?
Not that I'm aware of, no. I've not heard anything. I mean, in fact, the chain is branching out more and more into other sectors, including selling gasoline and also getting into banking services, which is raising quite a ruckus here.
Walmart is getting into banking services.
That's what they're trying to do, yes.
So in individual communities, we're talking about the gas station, the bank, the local store, the general store, the clothing store, the rest, all of this gets blown off, and those people who are community leaders and the lawyers, the accountants, and other people that interact and work with them, we're destroying community. Is that right?
Well, that's one implication of our work and one interpretation of it. And as I said, we're exploring it further, and there is preliminary evidence that this is indeed what's happening.
And, Richard, this is what you're seeing happening, right?
Yeah, because what we're saying, if you get the control of everything, like they go with gas, what are they going to do next? They're going to put the price they want if they're alone. You need competition to have good prices.
Richard, what you know? The funny thing is, I was speaking to one of the union heads who's successfully unionized two Walmart stores, the first two Walmart stores in North America that have been unionized have been here in Quebec. And, you know, it's all wonderful to be able to save $1.25 on an egg beater, but it's not that great when you've got your unemployment going up by 10% or more because they came in to save that $1.25. Richard, what would you like to see the Trump administration do?
I would like to see them protect us. They won't vote. What do? Before election, they come to us. They shake their hand. What can we do for you? Then after that, they stab us in our back, and they put a big box around us. The only thing I want is keep them in the suburb, keep them away like they are now. Don't put them in the heart of our community.
It's bad enough they're on the carrier already.
Yeah.
Professor Getz, Richard just mentioned the big box stores. This is a phenomenon related mostly to the way Walmart does business rather than the big box store concept, no?
Well, it's spreading to the others, though. I mean, they are forced to compete at the same level, if you will, and it has repercussions for the local labor market. I mean, it's not just the people who supply the store, but also the people who are independent operators, such as plumbers or electricians, who increasingly see their business being routed through these stores, and they then face a single buyer of their services. And there's some evidence to suggest that their wages and salaries are also under pressure.
Hal Newman has a question, but just before the question, Richard, if Montreal groups and social action groups want to support you, where can they reach your coalition?
You can reach out at the SIDAC Masson at 525-4386, I think.
525-4386.
4386. We got a coalition of the Ontario, Promenade Ontario, Saint-Hubert, and you got the Mr. From the Carrière-Miron from Saint-Michel. All those people are getting together. We have a support. I think I read we have support from the TUAC to support us because
the TUAC is the Food and Commercial Workers Union, who successfully unionized two of the stores.
Yeah, and what I'm saying in Quebec, we always hear that we are a special, distinct society. Are we that distinct when we see those big bucks coming in and closing everything? I don't know if we're that distinct. We follow
on. C'est le temps de rester fidèle à notre patrimoine progressiste politique.
Protect
Stephen, that means it's time to stay loyal to our progressive political patrimony. Stephen Getz, professor at Penn State, Richard Taraborelli, head of the Masson Street Merchant Association, 525-4386, Montreal, giving your support.
Keep up
Get
the
out
work.
There. Do the kind of work that you're seeing the Hal Newmans and the Pamela Ferez and the Richard Taraborellis and the Andre Rufos are doing, because Montreal and Canada, a society of sheep, will always beget a government of wolves. We'll be back with you next week. Out for now.